It was easy to play it cool with my other coworkers, but Celeste had the uncanny ability to see through my bullshit. I desperately avoided eye contact while she steamrolled her way over to our corner of the room. She hovered while I hunched over my bag, pretending to be too preoccupied to talk.
"So?"
she began, somewhat annoyed.
"Yeah, what's up?"
I feigned ignorance and asked.
"What the fuck was that?"
I stared at a bottle of prescription sulfate face wash.
"That takes some balls. I thought you guys were supposed to peck or something. I didn't realize there would be so much tongue."
I fiddled with my degree clinical for men deodorant stick.
"Dude, what was that? Are you mad? Did you plan that?"
I tightened the cap of my ingrown hair serum roll-on and began to realize how many products it took to make me less disgusting, and, oh crap, she was staring right at me.
"Oh my god, no, AJ, ew, you liked it?"
"Liked it?" I was appalled by the question. How could I like something so intrusive, so unwarranted? I was just trying to do my job, and he chose to be rude and unprofessional and basically violate the unwritten rules of my mouth. This wasn't the first time I found myself morally strained by what was asked of me at work. This wasn't the first time I felt humiliated. This wasn't even the first time I found myself involuntarily dry-heaving over a garbage can seconds before having to go live on air. But it was the first time it mattered, and I had no idea why. Earlier that evening, I had arrived at the arena on a high. The night before, I had starred in the main event of the show. In one of my character's darkest moments, she reacted to a lack of attention with a feigned attempt at self-harm. At the close of the show, in front of thousands of fans, I stood on the top rope of the ring, looking down onto a propped-up table 8 feet below. My body language conveyed that I was about to throw myself through the table, like a suicidal cry for attention. It was some heavy stuff, and I was blown away by the balls of steel the writing staff displayed by going through with such a dark story. Of course, at the start of the day, the original version had me successfully crashing through the table, an idea I was so stoked about. But by showtime, in an attempt to be slightly more responsible to our PG audience, the plans had hastily changed. When I climbed to the top rope and looked at certain devastation, CM Punk came to my rescue and stopped me from hurting myself. As he tried to talk me down, I grabbed the back of his head and punched him with my snaggle tooth while forcing a kiss on him. I then pulled away, revealed an adorably evil smile, and pushed him to the ground and through the table. It was deliciously twisted. The episode closed on my maniacal face enjoying the carnage I had wrought. Punk was a mentor to me at work. My first day on the road, as I walked into catering, with the same insecurity and nerves of a new student walking into the school cafeteria, he had called me over. I had never met him, only heard stories of his being a mercurial curmudgeon, so naturally, I was surprised. The simple act of inviting me to sit down at his table alleviated so much stress of finding somewhere to fit in on the road. "Let me know if anyone fucks with you, kiddo." "Kiddo" was an annoying moniker he gave me to remind me that I was about a decade younger than him. In turn, I gave him the nickname Grandpa. While I competed on NXT, he provided sage advice and encouragement. He delivered color commentary for the show and always made sure to put me over, or speak fondly of me, while he ruthlessly mocked the rest of the girls. I think he was indignant about the fact that while the other commentators audibly drooled over the rest of the contestants, they would only mention that I was diminutive and scrawny. His words were in support of different kinds of beauty, and it let me know that he had my back. When we started working together, our dynamic became that of a big brother and little sister. We had practically nothing in common besides a love of comic books and a belief that marriage was a ridiculous societal expectation, but we could talk for hours. We would seek advice from each other about the people we were in relationships with and share horrifying dating stories. Through these stories, we learned each other's flaws, mistakes, and embarrassing pasts.
but neither of us went running in the other direction. We apparently didn't scare so easy. He would bring me Starbucks coffee every day at work and mock me for being a chubster who always wanted extra whipped cream. This would soon be how he listed me in his phone, Extra Whip. Because as he explained, it represented how I was smart and feisty and also kind of a cow. He remained listed as Grandpa in mine. When we realized that we both had a bipolar parent, it connected us even more strongly. If I needed someone to talk to when I was frustrated about still having to support my family while trying to save money for my future, Phil would meet me at a Denny's at 2 a.m. and listen. When I was frustrated with work, I would call him from my hotel, and he would listen to me whine over the phone for hours. Our ability to trust in each other made sense. We had both grown up in impoverished, chaotic homes and used wrestling to pull ourselves out. We had both spent the majority of our adult lives trying to undo the handiwork of our parents. We put our guards up around most people, having learned the hard way that not everyone could be trusted. We were both independent after earning everything for ourselves in life. Neither of us was prototypical, and though we were underdogs, we came out on top. As our friendship grew closer, we simultaneously began fighting a lot. The most trivial things would send us at each other's throats. "Why did you leave the building without saying goodbye to me?" he once furiously texted before ignoring me for a week. But no matter what random nonsense was causing us to fight like cats and substantially older cats, if I needed a shoulder to cry on, the spat would be dropped and he would be there for me. Having to smash my face against his on screen was awkward as hell. The first time it really did feel like I was about to kiss my brother. But it was quick and simple, and before I knew it, I had thrown him through a table, so I felt fine. The next day at work, I was feeling pretty confident about having closed the show the night before with such a dramatic, high-octane scene. I had already kissed a plethora of guys on screen and figured that must have been the last. I was also really intrigued to see where the story would be headed. Running into one of the writers, I got the vibe I was about to be disappointed. "Are we doing anything fun today?" I hopefully asked. "Depends on your definition of fun," he hesitantly responded. "Oh, God, do I have to kiss a guy again?" "Not exactly," he said. A sense of relief began to sweep over me. "You'll be kissing two, one after the other. Your move, Mono." While waiting in Gorilla, the control room situated directly outside the on-camera entrance to the ring, Phil could see my trepidation. The story called for me to break up a fight between Brian and Phil, who had both previously ignored me. First, I was to plant one on Brian, and as Phil walked away, stop him by laying one on him. "For those keeping score, I am somebody's daughter." "You look like you're gonna throw up."
"I'm not that gross, kiddo."
Phil was relishing how much I wanted to set myself ablaze.
"I'm fine. I'm always nervous before I go out there, but yes, you are gross."
"Is this what having a stroke feels like?"
"It'll be okay. Just make sure you rock my world."
"You're not funny, and you're not a nice person." I desperately tried to turn my attention to someone else, anyone else.
I successfully began a conversation with a writer when Phil leaned in, interrupting.
"You never know. You could be the one."
I froze, suddenly out of comebacks. The segment had gone off flawlessly. The Brian smooch was out of the way, and now I only needed to quickly smash my face on Phil's again, like we had been clearly instructed. Specifically, Phil was supposed to stand with his arms extended as if I were a sexual predator and he were screaming for help. I held my breath as I ran after an exiting Phil. He scratched his head and began walking up the ramp, his back to me. Dismounting from the ring apron to the mat below, I was sure my knees would buckle beneath me. As he moved farther away, I reached out and grabbed his wrist. Using his arm as a pivot, I swung his body around, forcing us to be face to face. His character was frustrated and confused and began to ask me what it was I wanted his attention for. I lunged forward, pulling his face to my minuscule height,
and placed my lips on his, shutting him up. And then something bad happened.
We're kissing! We're not supposed to be kissing! My brain screamed at my body.
I steadied myself by grabbing his neck and considered pulling away to save the integrity of the segment.
Just get out now. It'll be sort of what they wanted.
Okay. One, two, is that his fucking tongue? There is an unwritten rule in on-screen kisses. No goddamn tongue. Tongue makes the moment too intimate, too real. For a moment, I felt violated. Then I was infuriated. Then I was immediately very okay with it.
Phil put his arm around my waist and pulled me tight to his body. I clawed at his shoulder. Every single person in that building disappeared. It was the best kiss of my entire life. What was supposed to be an unreciprocated peck was now bordering on smut, a hardcore makeout session going 20 seconds overtime, live on air. We attempted to stop, and for a moment you can see us begin to pull apart, but hover just a second too long before Phil adds one last tug of my lip. Years later, I let him know that was my favorite part. When we pulled apart, I was certain my entire body was now equal parts human and equal parts a jello-like substance. I felt the overwhelming urge to run as far and as fast as I could. I stared at Phil and his smart-ass oops smile for what felt like 7 days, but was actually 3 seconds, and got the fuck out of there. I moved out of the shot so unexpectedly fast, the director didn't even have a chance to get the shots he needed. I ended up having to run back out on stage to let them get a shot of me smiling and patting myself on the back, while inside I was setting myself on fire. We left the editors scrambling, having to desperately cut to random shots of Daniel's face to avoid accidentally distributing a porno to our PG audience. Our hands roamed a bit too freely, and tongues were nauseatingly visible left and right. In fact, when the second airing came Friday night, there were significant camera angle changes and cuts to attempt to scar fewer children.
Oh my god, no, AJ, ew, you liked it?
Celeste seemed revolted and amused all at once.
No, ew, shut up!
I lied while she cackled and I recalled that weird moment behind the curtain. You never know, you could be the one. For the next 2 years, we went on dating other people, supporting those relationships while not realizing what we really wanted, being a mentor and student, and acting like a brother and sister. I think we both saw a possible forever in the other and ran screaming in the opposite direction. But after living in denial, fighting all the time, my character proposing to his and then agreeing to marry someone else, and after 2 years of the world's most bizarre foreplay, one day Phil and I just said, fuck it, and we jumped headfirst into a serious relationship. There was so much history between us, it was like starting a book in chapter 12. Understandably, those around us were shocked at how fast everything seemed to move after that. But for us, it felt like we had waited a lifetime to find our way to each other. A few weeks into dating, he got my lips tattooed on him. 1 month in, he asked me what my dream wedding would be. A few months later, we were married. Our wedding took place under string lights at home on a Friday the 13th. We were surrounded by candles, black roses, and 10 family members. In my vows, I thanked Phil for having an ass that won't quit in front of a reverend and my father, and then we high-fived. And one day, if I forget to take my pill, we can tell our child that after our first kiss, Mommy put Daddy through a table. And the rest of our story is just for us. So how did I end up believing in marriage? I'm still not entirely sure I do. I certainly will never be one of those people who judgmentally preach to their single friends about settling down already. Because honestly, marriage is not for everyone. It is not the prize your life should be building toward, just because that's how fairy tales end.
It pains me to witness how much stock some women put in marriage, as if they will only find happiness once someone puts a ring on their finger. As women, our life goal should not be to belong to somebody else. Marriage should be the cherry on top of our accomplishments, not the whole sundae. I had made a list of goals, and marriage was not on it. No man was going to complete me. I was a complete person all on my own. When Robbie got married to his beautiful wife, Dayara, and had twin daughters, seeing the monumental change in him was inspiring. To witness him create the stable and healthy home he never had made me realize there were virtues in beginning your own family, creating your own place in the world. When Erica, having wasted her time on numerous asshole boyfriends, married Ro, a gentle, caring, dedicated soul who also happened to be a chick, I realized that love can be unexpected. It will profoundly change you. When my mother chose to not come to my wedding, I was reminded that sometimes love does not conquer all. I don't know why Janet refused the invitation. I offered to pay for the trip and hotel stay, as well as having paid for the small wedding and my dress myself, so I knew it wasn't the money. I understood she had grown fearful of flying, but she had often talked about having plans to fly back to the States. So what made those trips more feasible, more worthwhile? She told me Dad could represent them both, and I accepted that as some part of her disorder getting the best of her and holding her back. I need to believe that. I love my mother and I forgive her for everything, but we are still broken. There are so many normal, traditional, arguably expected mother-daughter moments girls can take for granted, moments I never got to have, moments, even as a grown woman, I still ache for like a child. I am jealous of every girl whose mother taught her about becoming a woman. I am jealous of every girl who got to cry to her mother when a boy broke her heart. I am painfully jealous of every girl who got to have her mother at her goddamn wedding. That is the moment I mourn the most. That is the moment that taught me that no love comes with guarantees. When my father kissed my cheek and gave me away, I realized sometimes, if you're lucky, you get exactly the love you need. What I had learned about love throughout my life was enough to make me question its resilience, but I had also learned that it could be worth the risk, and I had grown confident in my knack of leaping without looking. I found the person who complimented me like no other. I met my match, my best friend, my dream guy. Like our customary traded coffee, he could be bright and sweet, or dark and bitter, but always hot and never far from my mouth. Getting married just felt like the right thing to do. There was no louder, more meaningful way to dedicate ourselves to partnership. Phil likes to tease that if I hadn't been so mean to him all the time back then, we would have been married 2 years earlier. But I don't think I was always mean. I think I was scared. Something in me knew he could be the one, and the promise of stability can be terrifying. Because with the comfort of stability comes the fear of losing it. But ironically, the best relationships will make you more independent. A good man will love you so much, he will remind you of how immensely worthy of love you are. A secure man will love you because you love yourself first. I knew I was ready for marriage because I was comfortable with being alone. I am self-assured enough to know I will not be broken or less than without a ring on my finger. But when you don't need someone, you get the privilege of choosing them. You get to choose each other every day. And what is more meaningful than that? With loyalty, understanding, and a little bit of work, we will make that choice until we are wrinkly and gray. Him long before me. I have never believed in forever. But now, I hope for it. I guess what I'm trying to say is that marriage is not the only way to live happily ever after. But if you're lucky enough to find someone who stimulates your mind as successfully as your loins, lock that shit down. Diary of an Unfit Mind, How to find love. Reject every guy who approaches you. Even if he was just going to ask for the time, reject him anyway. If he keeps trying, he must really like you. Remember that a partner will only respect you as much as you respect yourself. Don't go looking for it. If fate is real, tempt her by declaring you are willing to die a virgin and live comfortably in your asexual sweatsuits. Have a kick-ass career. It'll be hard to give a shit about the other side of the bed being empty when it's filled with stacks of cash, keeping you warm. How to keep love. Consistently knock your partner down a few notches. Not so far down they lose the confidence you first found attractive, but just far enough to remind them that they will never do better than you. Openly talk about poop. In the marry, fuck, kill game of life, be all three. Be okay losing it. You are the prize that must be won. How to know he's the one. If he always holds your hand when you cross a street. If he brings you coffee in bed every morning. Because he knows without it, you are a monster. If he leaves you sweet notes literally everywhere. Under your pillow, in your books, in your luggage. Sometimes between the bread of a sandwich. If he always opens the car door for you, manners are sexy as hell. If he forgives you for that time you went jogging together and you pulled ahead and screamed, "Help, he's chasing me!" If he thinks you are the most beautiful with no makeup on and frizzy air-dried hair. If he adopts the dog you've been eyeing to help you recover from surgery. And even though you worry what he brought home might actually be a chupacabra or an old man that has been cursed by a gypsy, you raise him as your son anyway. If he buys you a car, but it ends up being the biggest fight you ever have because you are irrationally defensive of your independence, so he reluctantly trades it in and forgives your ungrateful response. If you mention ice cream at 10 p.m. and he quietly sneaks out to buy you ice cream at 10:02. If he's not intimidated by the fact that Mama has her own bank account and pays her own bills. If he has always made you feel like the prettiest girl in the room, even when you were just friends, even when you were mean to him. And most important, if he waits until you pause the video game to walk past the TV, that guy's a keeper. Chapter 13. Girl on girl. I fear children. Mostly because I worry that they will fall into a pile of broken glass or set themselves on fire while in my charge, but also because they can be unpredictable. And the last thing I want is a pair of creepily tiny and inexplicably sticky hands moving haphazardly in my general direction. I'm hesitant about having children the same way I used to be hesitant about getting married, so perhaps this too shall pass. But I'm not ready to share my action figures with anyone else just yet. So unsurprisingly, when the WWE presented me with the opportunity to speak at a school assembly composed of over 100 children under the age of 12, I politely replied, "Fuck that noise." But after I realized the event was a part of a well-intentioned anti-bullying campaign meant to spread the message of tolerance and acceptance within schools, as well as completely mandatory, I jumped in with both feet. Upon arriving at the middle school, I was brought into an empty classroom and handed a thick, extensive handbook filled with pages of integral information, hundreds of conversation starters, frequently asked questions, and a structured discussion outline. A course guide, so detailed, carrying such an important message, we were entrusted to convey to impressionable minds during their formative years, would take a rigorous amount of studying and preparation. "Can you read this in 20 minutes and head out there?" "I'm sorry, what now?" I hoped the event coordinator was making a terribly cruel joke. "You'll be fine, trust me. Most of this stuff comes naturally. And if you need us to take over the conversation, just give us a signal, and my team will take care of any code red." She laughed. For a while, it seemed as if I might actually be pulling off the impossible. I had wrangled the kids' attention, and they were actually pretty responsive. They even laughed at my jokes, presumably because those jokes were finally being heard by a demographic of equal maturity. I thought while I had them smiling, it would be a good time to start a Q&A session. Kids love when they have to stand up and be vulnerable among their peers. I spotted a sweet little girl wearing a thick pair of glasses in the crowd. She couldn't have been older than 10 and was preciously tiny. Sitting quietly, fiddling with the hem of her dress, she seemed a delicate introvert, almost sad. Perhaps the assembly was striking a nerve. Maybe she was a victim of bullying or knew someone who was. I thought, I will help this girl find her strength. I will give her support in front of her whole school and give her a chance to finally speak up. I'm so great at this. Tell me, how would you help a friend who is a victim of bullying? I asked the gentle wallflower as an event participant handed her a live microphone. As three different cameras circled the girl, hoping to get footage for a promotional reel about the company's charitable efforts, she nervously pushed at her glasses. Well,
bitches be trifling.
Code red.
Code red.
The microphone, for some reason, had not been pulled away, and so the tiny mobster continued.
Sometimes you just gotta slap a bitch if you want her to shut up.
My eyes bounced around the room, searching for an event coordinator to save me.
Didn't they say I just had to signal for them to swoop in? Wait, did we even designate a signal? I feel like hyperventilating should be a pretty strong signal. How could this be happening with all my extensive training?
Help never came, and or I blacked out, but somehow we stumbled through the rest of the assembly. Ultimately, I doubt the correct response to that comment was in the handbook. But what really worried me was the instinctual response of a mere 10-year-old girl when asked about her confrontations with her peers. That was a hard B she responded with. At the tender age of 10, she had learned to use a word so full of hate and spite. She had learned to view her fellow female race as enemies, and conflict between them was to be solved with aggression and violence. After getting into so many scuffles in school, I finally saw how terrifying adults must have found me. But I was more worried about the word bitch being on the tip of a child's tongue. It was an attitude so deeply entrenched in our culture, so ingrained in the lessons passed down, a child had learned to use it as a weapon. If society disagrees with a woman's opinion, finds her anything but pleasant, or views her as a threat, the go-to response is to call her a bitch. There are so many men who will instinctively hurl this insult at women, but I've already discussed men's violent behavior toward women. What is truly painful to witness is when women use this word to attack other women. We already have so many obstacles to overcome just trying to be seen and treated as equal to men that it seems laughable that women would further try to tear one another down. Instead of unite to make the uphill climb a little bit easier, it seems we are getting in our own way. Throughout my career, I've had women try to sabotage, manipulate, and trash talk me, but I've just never had the will to respond in kind. I went to a wonderful high school, full of warm, supportive, and encouraging men and women, so maybe I just missed the years in which childish behavior is prevalent. But it was in high school that I realized how important it was to come together in order to become stronger. My public school was in an underprivileged town, full of kids who were desperate to make a better life for themselves. And in our united struggle, we knew not to make life harder for anyone else, but to try to raise us all up. The football team played ticketed games to help raise money for the drama club. Cheerleaders, artists, and honor society presidents were all members of the Key Club, a group designed to organize charitable functions, grow our school library, and mentor younger grades. My own peer mediation group gave up their meager allowances to help me go to college. It was there I learned the very cheesy but very truthful idea that standing united yields stronger results than trying to tear one another down. As not just women, but women in a competitive field, facing generalizations, discrimination, and misogyny from a thousand different angles, the only way to survive and succeed would be to work together. And from what I've noticed in wrestling, the women who could not come to grips with that notion essentially shot themselves in the foot. One of the reasons I was constantly utilized on screen, always in a main event angle, and working with the best in the industry was simply because I was easy to work with. I did not perpetuate girl-on-girl violence. I was not the kind of girl who was going to cry when I had to lose, or the kind of girl who was going to barge into a boss's office and demand I not work with a particular competitor. I would not rat out anyone's bad behavior, but these were prevalent tactics of the less successful. That's not to say I didn't confront a woman if there was a problem. I fully admit that I can be brutally honest and that it doesn't rub everyone the right way. But I never tweeted about my confrontations, talked about them in interviews, or whispered about them to my friends. A real woman has the strength of character to face conflict head-on, carry herself politely throughout it, and to move on when she said all she has to say. I am comfortable telling women how I feel, but a lot of women are not comfortable being confronted. I think the only way men will stop making cartoon cat noises when women disagree is if women can learn to embrace conflict instead of talking harshly about another female the instant she has left a room. Overall, I prefer talking shit to someone's face. We don't need to yell and scream and insult each other. We simply need to have the guts to say, "I don't like you," or "I don't like this thing you did." Let it go and continue being fair, civil, and collaborative. I don't think it's a coincidence that the most success I've ever had has been when I and another woman decided to do everything in our power to support each other. It was our mission to make each other look good. My friendship with fellow female wrestler Caitlin, real name Celeste, has been well documented on camera. On paper, we should not have been friends. I was the wrestling purist. She was a fitness model the company begged to sign on. I spent 2 years in FCW before making it to TV, while she spent exactly 2 weeks. The canceled storyline I was supposed to have on my SmackDown debut was given to her for NXT, a show she went on to win. She got to travel the world, while I died a slow death in FCW. Though we seemed like complete opposites and destined enemies, we were startlingly alike in personality and became almost obnoxiously attached at the hip. Often literally, as Celeste would carry me through the halls of each arena while I straddled her like a clingy child. We traveled hundreds of miles a week together, roomed together, laughed at inside jokes annoyingly loud while coworkers blankly stared at us, and often washed each other's hair in the locker room sink. No one could believe that when we eventually got married, it wasn't to each other. She, too, would experience a different kind of pressure at work. Celeste was jacked like the forbidden love child of Wonder Woman and She-Ra. Higher-ups were concerned her muscles would be too intimidating and relegated her position on TV until she could slim down. On a live show, she took part in a multi-woman battle royal. The goal of a battle royal was to knock each opponent out of the ring until one person was standing inside of it. That woman would be given a shot at the championship. Celeste, a beast, hit our friend and intended winner of the match, Eve Torres, so hard she accidentally knocked her out of the ring and won the match. Oh, convenient circumstance, we meet again. While a bunch of pissed-off people gathered backstage, I ran into Celeste's arms like she had just come back from Vietnam, and we laughed so hard, people started to give us dirty looks. Eve ended up laughing it off as well. Maybe because she was a rational human, or maybe because she had a lot of other things going for her, like having a genius IQ, or always looking so beautiful I'm convinced cartoon birds from a Disney movie help her get dressed in the morning. Either way, she was cool with the accidental storyline change. When Celeste was actually awarded the championship, I cried like a proud mama. I was honored to be her opponent in her tryout. Fierce competition in her first televised match on NXT, and the first person to hug her once that title was wrapped around her waist. No one deserved that moment more. But her moment would be bittersweet. At the time, even being the champion wasn't a guarantee for television segments. The role of a female competitor was still being limited to 1-minute to 3-minute matches, with little story built around them to captivate the audience in the least. I was fortunate enough to still be embroiled in storylines that were prominent, because they heavily featured men. I got to leave Daniel Bryan at the altar, and then, just moments later, be chosen by Vince McMahon to run the Raw show as general manager. The original plan for the wedding segment was for psychiatric orderlies to drag me away after a ring was on my finger, and though I was initially bummed I didn't get to channel my inner Harley Quinn, I loved getting the opportunity to be a 5'2" boss of giants, though I be but little. After that, I got to be a part of another romance storyline with the company's top star, John Cena, who had been a mentor and supporter for my first days on the road. I then had my long-awaited bad guy turn with fellow heels Dolph Ziggler and Big E Langston. Dolph and I got to play our very own version of Mickey and Mallory, and the three of us produced both hilarious and controversial TV segments. The opportunities were plentiful and appreciated. The company execs found not only that they could count on me to deliver in performance, but also that I had become a top attraction with the crowd. The next logical move was to put me in the title chase. I could not have written my dream scenario any better. I was getting to work with my best friend in wrestling, and because so little attention was being paid to the women's division, we were accidentally given a lot of creative control. Writers who were considered lower tier were assigned to work with us, and they were so cool and open-minded, it became more of a collaboration. I felt like I was finally using the creative writing muscles I had long abandoned. Being able to use the power of my mind reminded me of a strength and value I had forgotten about. Though occasionally, giving us free rein on dialogue produced ridiculous results, like this backstage segment. AJ, walking past Caitlin. Oh God, please don't hit me. Oh, sorry. I thought you were going to savagely attack me from behind, like you did at Extreme Rules, a pay-per-view. My bad. Caitlin. Oh, that's funny, because the way I remember it, you are the one always savagely attacking me. So yeah, it felt kind of good to get my revenge. And speaking of savages, I'd like my Savage Garden CD back. AJ. Your Savage Garden CD? That was a gift, I'm pretty sure, so. Caitlin. No. I believe I left it in your car during an 8-hour road trip to Dinosaur World, which, by the way, huge letdown. AJ. You said you liked that trip. Caitlin. Well, I faked it. AJ. Huh. Well, speaking of things that we never liked, your grandma is the worst. Caitlin. She hemmed all your pants. Okay, you know what? 10th grade, your first crush, Bobby Dutch? I did make out with him. AJ. You knew I was in love with him. Okay, you want to play it like that? Remember when you laughed so hard you had to change your pants at that party? Well, I told everyone. Caitlin. I never read your screenplay. AJ. I worked so hard on that buddy cop drama. Starring us. Caitlin. Cops by day, dancers by night, it'll never work. AJ. You never believed in me. Caitlin. I can't believe I wasted 8 years of my life on you. AJ. You were a terrible best friend, okay? I want those years back. Caitlin. You will never get them back. AJ. I should bite your face right now. So, there's that. We shot it in one take, and our director stared at us blankly. I don't think we can use any of that. They didn't give us a script. They said to improvise, so... And surprisingly, it became the company website's highest viewed video. People enjoyed our absurdity. They liked seeing girls show different sides of themselves, even if those sides told really asinine jokes. Celeste and I were always on the same page, and our senses of humor and personalities gelled so naturally because of our existing friendship. We wanted the other to come out looking good. In speaking segments, we made sure we both had solid lines, and in physical altercations, we accentuated each other's strengths. She was the dominating, tough force of nature, and I was the scrappy, feisty scoundrel who was probably hiding a shank. The chemistry between us in these interactions intrigued the audience and the producers more than expected. This led to the decision to extend our storyline by an entire 2 months. One of our assigned writers, Tom Cassiello, was so open-minded and collaborative, believing the best stories came from actors who were on board, comfortable, and confident. He would check in with us multiple times throughout the week and gave us free rein to formulate how a story would play out. We were even trusted with writing my career's most important promo in front of a live audience, in which Celeste and I finally came to blows. It was our last meeting before the title would be on the line. She let me call her trailer trash, and I let her slap the taste out of my mouth. Well, she probably could have done that without me letting her, but I was nice enough to clench my teeth to make sure it didn't break my jaw. During our storyline, I was finally given merchandise. Only 3 women in the history of the company had their name attached to merchandise, sold at shows, and on the online store. And the last was a decade before I arrived. The marketing department let me know a year earlier, as I tried to pitch for my own merchandise, that women don't sell. When they had considered giving a girl a hat as merchandise a few years earlier, the other women on the roster complained so much they scrapped the idea. Since then, they hadn't wanted the trouble and didn't think it was worth the backlash, because women don't sell. It was widely thought that not only did women not sell, but they couldn't get ratings either. My main event storylines had begun to change a lot of people's minds, but they weren't sure if the bulk of the credit rested on the shoulders of my male counterparts. And frankly, neither was I. When Celeste and I embarked on a journey alone, I wasn't sure if I would be proven wrong. Had I just been carried all this time, or was I indeed a ratings pull on my own? I had petitioned the marketing department several times, showing them how many fans on social media, at shows, and at signings were mimicking and cosplaying my outfits. I purposely chose an outfit for my character that was the same in and out of the ring. This would make it more recognizable. I made sure it could be easily recreated by fans and lend itself to cosplay. I wanted fans to feel connected to my style. They could walk around a mall and buy my exact outfit for $30. They would cut up plain t-shirts, buy my Target jean shorts, rock a sweet pair of knee-high chucks, and do great justice to my messy, boyish style. I felt instead of girls just cutting up their own t-shirts to look like mine, why not sell a sponsored product with my name on it so we could all make money? I fought with them over and over again, and then something magical happened. During our storyline, Celeste and I were the highest-rated segment on the show, an unprecedented 6 times. Our writer was even promoted to a main event storyline in an attempt to continue pulling in high numbers, but for the men. Our bosses even added themselves to our storyline in front of the camera and creatively. I was the first woman to be given merchandise in a decade. They produced several different t-shirts, hats, knee-high socks, and posters. I was the only female on a WWE-themed Monopoly board. Though my property was worth the least, I was still psyched and ignored the perfectly sad allegory. I was on wrapping paper, birthday cards, and dinnerware. I wasn't sure if it was weirder being made into a garden gnome or a gingerbread man Christmas tree ornament, but I was grateful for it all. My merchandise remained in the highest sellers list, beating out several more prominently featured men every year I was in the company. I remembered talking to the merchandise department when I was just a rookie on NXT. Joe Hickey and his crew were funny and inviting, though when I told them they would for sure produce at least one merchandise item for me one day, they all laughed in unison. At the time, it just wasn't feasible for a woman. A member of talent relations was there and joked, "Just one piece of merch? How about 5? As he playfully or condescendingly punched my arm and laughed off my foolish dream. 3 years later, they made about 100. We were successful in changing minds, and I could not have done that without Celeste by my side. She was next to get her own t-shirt, and we could not be prouder. Not only was working together creating solid results on screen, but we were helping each other make a lot of money. At this point, it just seemed silly to do anything besides have the back of the woman you are working with. Ladies, you don't have to be friends. You don't have to like each other's clothes or disingenuously compliment each other's hair, but you have to know how to work together. Work together and watch yourselves get rich together. When our title match finally came in 2013, I felt the pressure of 14 years of a little girl's dreams on my shoulders. I had wanted to call myself the best women's wrestler since I was 12. And at 26, I was about to be given the opportunity to make that dream a reality. I thought about every step I had taken to get to that moment, every obstacle that had been put in my way, and the battles I had waged to overcome them. I wanted to protect that little 12-year-old's dreams, that girl with the naughty hair, the survivor who did not want to be a victim anymore. I owed her sanctuary and protection. I owed her the best moment of her life. I needed to make her dreams come true. It was the best match of my career. Halfway through the bout, Celeste and I were told to wrap it up early to help cut down on an already overrunning show. But women had endured having their matches shorted for time for years, and after delivering months of top-rated programming, I would be damned if we got screwed again. And so I grabbed Celeste's head and pressed my mouth against her ear as I lifted her before a move. They want us to go home. Want to get in trouble and ignore them? Hell yeah, I do. Our match went 10 minutes over our allotted time and was one of the longest women's title bouts in history. But I think it was one of the best, and we didn't get in trouble because it was worth the wait. I won my first championship, but it felt like more than just that. It felt like the culmination of a lifetime of hardship, work, and desire. I felt like I kept a promise to a little girl. Chapter 14. Crazy Chicks Do It Better. When I was 16, my dad wanted to do something special for my upcoming 17th birthday. He had found some consistent work as a doorman in a New York City high-rise, and for a wonderful moment in time, we were not scrounging to get by. When he found out WrestleMania was going to take place only a few days before my birthday, and only a few miles from home at Madison Square Garden, Dad worked overtime to save up $250 to give me the surprise of my life. But he didn't have a credit or debit card, so to buy tickets to the biggest wrestling show of the year, he would have to stand in line at the Garden to pay in cash. Instead of seeing that as a hole in his plan, he used it to create an adventure. Dad and I took the train to Penn Station with a plastic bag full of water bottles and snacks. It was the first time just the two of us had been on an outing. Having his undivided attention brought me immeasurable joy. We came prepared to stand in line among what would undoubtedly be a horde of people trying to score seats. The line was enormous, circling around the entire block. After 4 hours of spending the time talking, laughing, and sporadically shuffling 2 feet over, Dad left the line to grab us some McDonald's, and we nibbled on fries to get us through the next four. After standing in line for a grueling 8 hours, we finally approached the ticket window. "What are the best seats I can buy for $250? Dad hesitantly asked the tired man behind the glass. "Well, unfortunately, most everything has been bought up through Ticketmaster. Right now I have a few $80 seats left." Dad was deflated. He had worked so hard to save and couldn't buy the seats he wanted me to have. But I was on cloud nine. I had tickets to my first live wrestling show, and it was the most monumental event of the whole year. A few months later, when we took the train into the city for WrestleMania 20, I kept waiting for something to go wrong. I rarely received birthday presents, and I had never had a dream come to fruition. Everything always seemed out of reach,
a destination for another distant day. One day we'll have a nice house. One day you kids will get some nice clothes. One day we'll go to a wrestling show. But one of those days was today, and I couldn't believe it was really happening. As we entered the historic arena, my skin tingled with excitement. A few hours before showtime, the building was flooded with thousands of fans hectically trying to get to their seats. After riding three different escalators, we were sure we had made it to the top of the building and entered the cavernous arena bowl to hunt down our row. The place was lit up with bright lights and jumbotrons, and at its center was a specially decorated wrestling ring.
"This is a pretty good view." Dad was excited. The seats seemed better than he had thought they would be.
"Excuse me, sir," he called to an usher. "Can you tell me where section 426 is?" The usher illuminated our tickets with his flashlight and studied them. Row E, seats 17 and 18. Yeah, that's not here. You guys have to go up two more levels. Escalators are out that way." He flippantly handed back what he clearly deemed to be lowly tickets and waved us away with the flick of his hand. I could see my dad grit his teeth to stop himself from socking the guy on the spot. I appreciated his restraint on this, the day of his daughter's pre-birthday. We hadn't realized this building even had two more levels. Craning my neck up, I squinted at the nosebleed section connected to the building's ceiling and read 426. 15 minutes later, we finally found our seats, which were basically in New Jersey, and I quickly realized I had a fear of heights. As I tried to adjust to the steep row that made me feel like I was a second away from plummeting to my death, my eyes found the now minuscule ring. I looked over at Dad. He had tears in his eyes. "I'm sorry I couldn't get you better seats, baby. I tried my best." He had always tried his hardest to give us what he could, to make us happy with however little we had. I know deep in my heart, he tried his best our whole childhood, and I would try my best to one day make him proud of me. "Don't worry, Daddy. This is perfect. Besides, one day, I'm going to be in that ring." 10 years later, at 2014's WrestleMania 30, I walked into that ring as champion, wrestled the entire female roster, and I walked out of that ring as champion. And that was the day I knew my fight was over. There could be no better full circle moment. After a decade, I had not only accomplished my goal of stepping foot inside of a WrestleMania ring, I had lived dreams I never even thought possible. Every goal had been checked off a list, every glass ceiling shattered within my first year and a half on television. Every amazing moment that came after was an unexpected bonus, frosting on top of a delicious Fudgy the Whale ice cream cake. I got to hold the title two more times and win the women's match at the next year's WrestleMania 31 as well. My cup runneth over. So when I had to have three surgeries for a health issue unrelated to the ring and discovered ring-caused permanent damage to my cervical spine that occasionally makes my arms go numb and my fingers wiggle like an indecisive wizard, I felt like the time was right to start planning the next chapter of my life. I began writing a new 10-year life plan that would pay forward the good fortune life had bestowed upon me. Maybe life made me work extra hard for that good fortune, made me truly earn it, but I still considered myself lucky. It was time to share the wealth. There were other strays like me out there searching for someplace warm and safe, so I began working with animal rescue organizations and became an activist for animal rights. There were other little girls, like I once was, out there in the world, worried about the clouds hanging over their heads. It was time to stop hiding my struggle and let them know they were not alone. And I began writing this book, this diary of the deranged. My husband and I started toying with the idea of creating a family. Even if we ended up not wanting children,
We had the desire to make for ourselves what we never had growing up, a peaceful, stable home. That place called home felt like a pot of gold at the end of one fucked up rainbow. When Phil became embroiled in a dramatic breakup with the company, I worried the stress and chaos would test my mental fortitude and wreck the peace I had worked so hard to find within my mind. But surprisingly, I guess through years of practice under pressure, I managed to hold it together, for the most part. There were days I felt so overwhelmed I would cry in a bathroom stall mere moments before heading onto live TV. At times I felt caught in the middle, like a child of divorce, trying to bridge the divide while getting inconsiderately trampled in the process. But despite what either side expected of me, what was more important to honor were my expectations of myself. The company gave me time off for surgeries, and I pushed my body through another year on the road. Just because my husband left didn't mean I had to follow. It was hard being newlyweds who only saw each other 2 days a week, but we were strong enough to handle it. I was going to wrestle for as long as it made me happy, and as long as my body would hold together. But in my heart, I knew there was nothing left to prove. There were no more mountains to climb, no more history to make. My war was over. I had won. It all felt so picture perfect, a career wrapped up in a tidy bow. I knew I had left the business better for women than when I had started, and it would be fine without me. I had kicked down doors for the next generation, and I had faith they would deliver. You either go out on the top of your game or watch yourself become less than your best. You either go out on your terms or let someone else decide your fate. I didn't want to fade out. I wanted to go out with a bang. I publicly called out my bosses for not paying or treating most women equally, even though I was proof that women could bring in just as much money and ratings for the company as men. All these years later, and I still hadn't learned how to be a good girl. I won at the biggest event of the year, on the grandest stage of them all. I thanked Vince McMahon for every opportunity, and I retired. All a woman needs to succeed is the guts to kick the door of opportunity open. All she needs is to be brave enough to be herself. For years, people tried to quantify whatever formula had led to my unlikely success. How could a woman who wasn't conventionally attractive, who wasn't physically imposing, who didn't fit the mold set before her, succeed where others had not? Was it the shoes? The clothes? Was it my smart mouth? Others have tried to replicate it all, but the answer was simple. I didn't try to be anything but me. When looks fade, and your only value is your mind, will you still be beautiful? I figured out early on that investing in my heart, my personality, my mind, and my soul was going to be the key to success. Fans connected to me. They cheered for me, and they fought alongside me because I was genuine. When someone is honest and raw on screen, the fans can see it. They can also tell when someone is not. Their bullshit meters are phenomenal. If you are the girliest girl in the world, then be that. If you are a freak or a geek, be that. Embrace it. And I promise the audience will embrace you too. Sometimes I felt like the fans could see my soul through the screen. I have met many at autograph sessions, and they have shared their gut-wrenching stories of depression, cutting, and suicide attempts. It is as if, without words, they understood my entire life story. Our struggles could sense a kinship in one another, and that connection is what made them a part of my revolution. I was honored to be their voice when they could not speak, their fists when they could not fight. If I could make it out of a dark past, then so could they. Now, it is their turn. I hope they will go on to be the superheroes they want to see in the world. Trying to please everyone will appeal to no one. I was successful because I was willing not to be, in order to be true to my beliefs and myself. Being polarizing, giving people an extreme to connect to, that is where the magic happens. We all have extremes in our emotions and opinions. We just have to be unafraid in expressing them. And that is the gift.